Have you ever been out with a group of friends and been involved in a situation that went too far? Did anyone get hurt? Did you face up to what you did? Tonight, we're going to meet Emma, who, after 50 years, is returning to the site of a deadly teenage prank to try and put it finally to rest. Just after this.
Calling all lovers of mystery and fans of a good story. If you haven't already heard me talk about June's journey, you're in for a treat. It's time to don your detective hat in this free hidden object mobile game that delves into the captivating journey of June Parker, a self-proclaimed detective on a quest to unravel the mystery surrounding her sister's untimely death. In June's journey, you get to play as June, deciphering clues and unveiling secret plots within thousands of beautifully illustrated scenes. And did I mention it's set in the glitzy 1920s? New chapters are added weekly, so you will never run out of new thrills to uncover, and you can also personalize and decorate your very own Orchid Island where the story takes place. How sharp are your detective skills? Find out when you download June's Journey on your Android or iOS device, or play online via Facebook Games. Your detective journey awaits. I'm someone who loves trying out different makeup looks, but doesn't really wear much on a daily basis, so I like to focus on making sure I have high quality staples. And whether you like a fresh face, full glam, or somewhere in between, you've probably seen Thrive Cosmetics Viral Tubing Mascara. I've certainly seen it everywhere. You know the one in the turquoise tube? So that mascara, along with all of Thrive Cosmetics' beauty products, are certified 100% vegan and cruelty-free, which I look for in makeup, and they've got excellent quality to match. And something I didn't know from all the mascara videos I've seen is that for every product sold, Thrive Cosmetics donates either that same product, another product that is needed more, or a monetary donation. They've worked with over 500 nonprofits to help with a wide range of causes like supporting cancer survivors, people experiencing homelessness, education access, and so much more. Knowing that makes me feel even better about using their products. And I do enjoy using them. Like I said, I like having high quality staples, and so my favorites are products that are multi-purpose, like the Brilliant Eye Brightener. It comes in a bunch of colors, and I like using them as eyeliner, eyeshadow, and even highlighter. Thrive Cosmetics is luxury beauty that gives back. Right now, you can get an exclusive 20% off your first order at thrivecosmetics.com/thrive. That's Thrive Cosmetics, CauseMetics, .com/thrive for 20% off your first order.
Hi, this is Fred Greenhalgh, your host of Undertow, Realm's podcast that takes you under the surface and into the weird and the wicked. And I am tremendously excited to share with you today a standalone audio play debuting here on Undertow, Return to Blackout Point. Return to Blackout Point was penned by Sean French, one of the four writers of our previous season, Blood Forest. We'll learn the story of Emma, who was part of a teenage prank that went way too far. And now, as she returns to the site of a deadly incident 50 years later, what happened on that fateful night and what she's done in the intervening years still hangs over her head. Up till now, we haven't mined Maine's rugged, rocky coast as a source of horror, and so I'm incredibly proud that Sean's story gets to be the piece that does so. It's a cold, windy, high-tide night in coastal Maine, and it's a dark road that we're on that leads to Blackout Point. Before we begin, note that this is an episode for mature listeners with violence and strong language. Listen if you dare.
I never imagined myself returning to Blackout Point, much less on this of all nights. 5 decades I've spent fleeing from this place, from that terrible night, from what we did. I had convinced myself that running was the only way to survive, but what do you do when there's nowhere to run? No one left to hide behind. And so I find myself driving into a blizzard on New Year's Eve, en route to a place I swore I'd never revisit. The setting of the nightmares that haunt my every dream. The lighthouse at Blackout Point. I used to tell myself I was running for survival. It isn't death I fear at Blackout Point, though, but a fate far worse. 11:30 p.m. 30 minutes until midnight. when my fate will be decided once and for all. I grew up playing on the rocks at Blackout Point, or Walker's Point, as it was known in those days. East Bank, or the bank to locals, was a close-knit coastal community a ways north of Rockland, Maine. 100 or so duplex apartments and a handful of businesses clustered around a school and a community center. Plus the lighthouse at Walker Point, and of course the lead mine, which, well, sounded like a good idea at the time. My mother worked in administration at East Bank Elementary, and as was the case with most of my friends in the bank, my father was never really in the picture. The year was 1972. I was 15 years old. The pack I ran with were Darren Walker, whose father owned half of East Bank, Russ Winslow, the most physically gifted athlete I've ever seen in person, my best friend Sarah, and her childhood sweetheart, Simon, who never quite got over her. The five of us were inseparable. We'd leave the house at sunrise and spend all day racing up and down the coast on our bikes or exploring every inch of the local islands on stolen kayaks we kept stashed in a culvert on the edge of town. At the time, I was always offended that parents from nearby towns and the islands didn't want their children playing with kids from the bank. But looking back, yeah, that was probably the right call. We were, as they say, trouble. It was the five of us against the world, and we were willing to kill or die for each other. How did it all go so wrong? It was New Year's Eve of that same year, 1972. While the rest of the bank were gathered at the bluff to watch the fireworks over Penobscot Bay, the five of us snuck off to Walker Point with a bottle Darren nicked from his father's liquor cabinet. We planned to just hang out on the rocks, but when the freezing rain and hail started to fall, Russ, who was drunk before we even met up, took it upon himself to smash a window in the lightkeeper's cottage and let himself in. I've analyzed that night 1,000 times over the ensuing 50 years, and that's the moment I always come back to. We could have stopped it right there. Had we left, he would have followed. Instead, we headed inside to get out of the cold. I'd never actually been inside the lighthouse before, and I'm still unclear if that was the moment I realized I was claustrophobic or the moment I became claustrophobic. Decades of fetid ocean air saturated the walls, which angled inward as if in attempt to smother us as we spiraled upward. I couldn't breathe. The thick sea air clogged my throat and lungs as my heart pounded out of my chest. The higher we went, the worse it got, and had it not been for Sarah immediately behind me, I surely would have fled back down the stairs. Instead, I hurried upward and out onto the gallery deck where I was finally able to regain my breath. Everything about that night felt off. I'd gotten into another screaming fight with my mother, who tried to forbid me from going out. Sarah had grown bored of Simon, but hadn't yet broken up with him, so that was all manner of awkward. Darren was unusually distant, and Russ was in full meltdown mode, having adopted the motto, "I'm gonna die anyway, so fuck it." Our group was unraveling, and alcohol only made things worse. I don't even know who it was that started trashing the lightkeeper's cottage below, but we all joined in, whether as an outlet for our fear and frustration or just for the sheer joy of destruction. As always, it was Russ who pushed things too far. Sarah and Simon were trying to get everyone to leave, but Russ was wild and out of control, hauling a rock the size of Darren's ego up the spiral staircase to put a punctuation mark on the night. The instant the lighthouse went dark, we knew we had made a terrible mistake. We ran away, agreed to never again talk about it, and were in our respective beds an hour before the ball dropped to ring in 1973. A that storm worsened as we slept, the hail bringing with it thick sea fog. One of those fancy sightseeing boats called for help. During the rescue, a volunteer responder got turned around in the storm and, without the lighthouse to guide him, wrecked on the rocks near Walker's Point. His final distress call coming at the stroke of midnight. We found out the next morning. And true to our word, we never told another soul what we'd done. We protected each other like we had always done. And we got away with it. Walker's Point became Blackout Point to locals, and the old lighthouse was decommissioned, replaced by one on an island in Penobscot Bay. Looking back, I'm nearly certain Darren's father sheltered us from consequences, but it still felt like everyone knew. I could feel their judging eyes everywhere I went. I left the bank after graduation and never returned. Until now. Simon settled down as an accountant in South Dakota, which he said is the farthest point in the U.S. away from an ocean. After all his complaints about the draft, Russ ended up dropping out senior year and enlisting in the Marines anyway. Darren moved off into the western woods of Maine to run one of his father's logging operations. And much to Simon's dismay, Sarah married her college sweetheart and started a family outside D.C., near enough to my place in Boston that we could still meet up a couple times a year. She and I remained close, but I mostly lost contact with the boys after we went our separate ways, initially at least. The lead mine closed in 77, and shortly thereafter, the whole community was found to have unsafe levels of lead contamination. In 1980, East Bank Township was disincorporated by the state and abandoned as a ghost town, which is how it remains today. We had each carried on with our lives and put that terrible night behind us, right up until the 10th anniversary. New Year's Eve, 1982. I was at a small rooftop party in Newton, Massachusetts, alongside a dozen random people from my apartment building, who each concluded they'd rather freeze on a roof with strangers than end their year alone. I regretted the decision to attend almost immediately.
4, 3, 2, 1.
As my fellow misfits began the countdown, I turned to leave in hopes of avoiding the awkward now-what post-midnight exchange of glances before we all shuffled off back to our empty apartments. That's when the wind picked up, carrying upon it a scent that stopped me dead in my tracks. Suddenly, I could feel the lighthouse walls pressing ever closer around me, my heart pounding wildly as I struggled for breath. The thick ocean air carried on the wind snaked down my throat, choking off my breath. And then I saw him. In place of his left arm, torn free in the shipwreck, a writhing mass of seaweed emerged from the tattered remnants of the captain's duffel coat. A sea-torn hood concealed his features as he shambled forward, a serrated rigging knife in his right hand. He reached for me, the grayish skin on his arm sloughing off like a snake shedding its skin. I stumbled back to the roof's edge, nearly slipping on ice. There was nowhere to run. The captain lumbered forward, his seaweed arm reaching for me like some grotesque tentacle. I tried to jump, but I found myself frozen in terror. I can still feel the cold sting as its monstrous lashes snaked around my head, pulling me closer, his breath like low tide. The captain leaned in, revealing his features for the first time. I screamed, my sanity stretched to its limits. Beneath his hood was no face, but an undulating nest of seaweed that snaked in and out of his clothes like sentient vines. I knew at that moment I was going to die, and worse yet, that I deserved it. And then he was gone. Faded into a rancid mist that seeped into my skin and took weeks of scrubbing myself raw to remove. I was quickly pulled from the ledge by my neighbors who couldn't see the captain and just thought the weird lady in 237B had gone mad at the stroke of midnight. I reached out to Sarah first and learned she had an identical encounter. She contacted Simon, who contacted Russ. Both told the same tale. We were unable to reach Darren. His body was found the next morning, his throat slashed by a rigging knife. The captain had appeared to each of us at the stroke of midnight on the 10th anniversary, vanishing as soon as he got revenge against one of his killers. As we swapped notes, a horrible truth became clear to me. The only way to survive the next time was by ensuring one of my friends died instead. It's a strange feeling not to recognize the region you grew up in. As best I can tell, the woods we grew up playing in have been entirely replaced by strip malls. Am I even in the right town? Yep, there's the turn. They seriously paved over an entire forest. Fucking progress. We drifted apart again after Darren's death. I didn't share my realization with them. That would have defeated the whole point, I suppose. People are quick to say they'd die for a friend, and maybe they would in a moment of snap judgment. I'd absolutely risk myself to pull Simon out of traffic. But when that moment of death is circled on your calendar and you have to watch it grow closer day by day by day by day by day, it gives a person time to think and to formulate a plan. I was an angry kid. Probably got a bit too much of my father in me for my own good. Despite the stress of single motherhood, my mother was always unflappable, though. She said most stress resulted from folks refusing to learn from their mistakes. We either admit our mistakes or repeat them. There ain't no third choice. She used to say, when a situation goes south, study what you did wrong and make a plan how to do it better next time. So that's what I did. The obvious issue in 82 was the setting: slippery ground, rooftop with a single exit, insensible footwear, out of shape, a little drunk. I panicked and froze, 300-foot plunge to my death in all directions. I did every single thing wrong and still survived, but barely. Darren must have been asleep and offered no resistance at all. I couldn't count on such luck next time. I ran my first Boston Marathon in 1986 and more than 80 other races since, including a handful of 100-mile endurance races. At an ultramarathon in France, I once ran for 48 straight hours. I spent my whole life training to run away from the encounter I now find myself driving toward.
Do you ever wonder who's looking over your shoulder when you're exploring the web? Do you want to keep tracking cookies, curious websites, and your internet service provider from sniffing out too much about your browsing activity? What about gaining the ability to virtually travel to different parts of the world and reshape your internet experience? Well, enter NordVPN. NordVPN protects your internet privacy and lets you go borderless. You can experience sporting events and entertainment that aren't available in your region. When you're on the go, NordVPN protects your data while accessing public Wi-Fi, and in tandem with the Nord Threat Protection Service, protects you from malicious downloads, viruses, and phishing sites. Best of all, this protection is laser fast, so avoid buffering and lagging while streaming or gaming, and stop your ISP from bandwidth throttling. If you've never used a VPN before, you may be surprised how much your internet experience is shaped by what country of origin you're believed to be from. I've actually had quite a bit of fun using NordVPN as a learning tool with my kids. We change around our virtual location, go to different countries, revisit familiar websites from a new country of origin, and see how things are different. For the cost of a cup of coffee a month, your NordVPN account can be used on up to 6 devices. So why wait? Get the best discount off your NordVPN plan by going to nordvpn.com/undertow. Our link will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. And there's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nordvpn.com/undertow.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm. As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
December 1992. I had my plan. Stay in open space with no external hazards and nothing to hide behind, keep him in eyesight at all times, and maintain distance at a pace I can sustain for days. No panicking, no running and tripping, just use my mobility advantage to avoid him and buy time until he catches someone else. Someone else. My dearest friend Sarah, who drove 8 hours to spend the weekend with me after my miscarriage. Sarah, who would leave behind a heartbroken husband and 2 motherless sons. Good boys, the both of them. No, not Sarah. Or Simon? Poor, sweet Simon, who had never harmed a soul in his life. Simon, who quit the firm and moved back to Maine to care for his ailing mother. What would become of her? No. Not Simon. Which left Russ, who none of us even talked to anymore. Russ, who had followed in his father's footsteps and become a violent, abusive drunk. Russ, the only other athlete in the group who could potentially outlast me. Russ, who had outstanding warrants. He was wanted for domestic violence assault and criminal threatening with a weapon, along with an extensive collection of parole violations. I found Russ living in a battered trailer in VZ, Maine, a hole-in-the-wall town a few hours inland from the bank. Duct tape and cardboard were haphazardly splayed across a broken trailer window in an apathetic attempt at repair, and crumpled beer cans littered the lawn. I waited until December 29th to provide his new address to both the sheriff and his parole officer. Russ was taken into custody the next day. I provided Sarah and Simon with some general advice. Open space, sensible shoes, calmly retreat, and stall, stall, stall. Meanwhile, I caught a flight to Vegas and set up camp a few miles outside the city. If Russ got free from his cell, I was prepared to outlast the others for as long as it took. Flat ground, clear visibility, no bodies of water or back seats for the captain to pop out of. I set up four supply checkpoints in a square pattern, each a mile apart, with a plan to keep the captain in sight while walking the circuit until he caught someone else. Worst case scenario, I figured I could outpace him for 60 hours. But it wasn't necessary that night. Russell James Howard died in a holding cell at 12:01 a.m. on January 1st, 1993. His throat slashed by a rigging knife. I never told Sarah or Simon what I'd done, how I'd saved their lives. I vowed to carry the burden of that secret alone. I blamed myself for years, my guilt fueled by recurring nightmares of walking along the old dock leading to the lighthouse and peering over the edge to see Russ and Darren's seaweed-entangled corpses below, struggling against their restraints for all eternity, doomed to never reach the surface, and waiting to see who will join them next. Despite how it felt initially, I now know that I didn't kill Russ. Russ killed Russ. His fate was sealed when he destroyed the lighthouse with a giant rock. We didn't do that. He did. Nobody intended to break anything, to kill anyone. We were just kids, blowing off steam. Did Russ deserve to die? Of course not. He was our friend. But that was never the question before us. The question was, which of us deserved to die the most? Of the four options, the answer was Russ. And so he did. And the three remaining kids from the bank got to live another decade. Russ's service was the first time I'd seen Simon and Sarah since Darren's funeral. That day, 10 years prior, had been a life-affirming reunion between old friends and felt like we'd never been apart. But now, I'm not sure what I expected, but the tension between myself, Simon, and Sarah was unbearable. I couldn't help sizing each of them up, and I could feel them doing the same to me. Simon still loved Sarah, would never turn on her. But would Sarah betray Simon to save herself? Were the two of them already plotting against me? Had they figured out that I was the one who turned Russ in? Mid-service, I flash back to the three-way standoffs and the old spaghetti westerns I loved so much as a kid and had to suppress an inappropriate laugh at the image. The funeral, for what it was, lasted only a few minutes and was attended by a total of 6 people, if you count the old-timer passed out under a nearby tree. If nothing else, the lack of turnout affirmed that I'd made the correct decision. After the service, we said our awkward goodbyes when what we really meant was, I hope it's you next time, not me. The only thing I knew for certain was that in exactly 10 years, two of us would be attending the funeral of the third. December 2002. Sarah and I had stayed in touch with regular monthly calls, but our conversations had become surface level. We never talked about the only thing that actually mattered, and I never forced the issue because I didn't want her to have time to think about what must be done. But I'd been making plans for the both of us. I was 45 years old and had continued running, although less intensely than in my younger days. My main focus became avoiding the training injuries that had become all too common since turning 40. Couldn't afford to go into New Year's Eve with blown ACL. I invited Sarah to spend the final week of the cycle with me, where I gradually won her over to my plan. A plan which involved two lies only she could deliver to Simon. First lie. I had survived the last two times because I was waist deep in the ocean, which the ghost wouldn't enter because that's where he died. He just stood on the shore unable to reach me. Second lie. The three of us would spend New Year's Eve together. Sarah wanted nothing to do with the plan initially. I wore her down with talk of seeing her grandkids grow, but ultimately what did it was the realization that we'd both been having the same dream every night for the past 20 years. Walking the old pier, looking over the edge and seeing first Darren, then Darren and Russ, entombed in writhing seaweed, forever struggling to reach the surface. I convinced her it wasn't a dream, and that a week from now, one of the three of us will be trapped down there as well. She called Simon and told him to meet us under the pier at Old Orchard Beach at 11:45 on New Year's Eve, that we'd face this together like we always did as kids and help each other survive until dawn, which hopefully would be enough. My relationship with Sarah was forever changed by that call. She refused to talk to me on the flight to Vegas, aside from one instance mid-flight when she abruptly turned to me and said, "You got Russ arrested, didn't you?" I didn't answer. I didn't need to. We finished the remainder of the flight in silence. By 11:30 p.m., we were set up outside Vegas, just as I'd been a decade before. Four supply checkpoints in a square pattern a mile apart. Sarah wasn't in particularly good shape, but neither was Simon. He'd also be running on wet sand as opposed to the packed clay beneath us. And with a bit of luck, he might actually believe he was safe in the ocean. At 11:45, an increasingly panicked series of voicemails and texts began rolling in from Simon, one after the other. I convinced Sarah to leave her phone in the car, and I placed mine on silent, pre-typing a last resort text message to send if my plan failed. As we entered the final minute of the year, Sarah kicked into full-blown panic attack, crumbling to the ground and repeating over and over, "What did you make me do? What did you make me do? What did you make me do?" I hauled her back to her feet as the alarm on my phone sounded. Midnight had arrived. The overpowering stench of rotting fish hit me like a wet towel. I looked up and there he was, draped in undulating seaweed, his hood concealing the mass of writhing vines I knew lay hidden beneath. Sarah screamed, but I dragged her away, snapping her from her terrified stupor. Initially, it seemed my plan would work, that we could simply outmaneuver the specter and outlast it until dawn. And then the fog rolled in. Knee-high and extending well beyond the edge of my light, the fog steadily congealed around us. At first, like dense cobwebs offering a bit of resistance but unable to slow our progress. But with each step, the fog thickened, pulling at us until it felt like running through thick porridge. The captain shambled forward at a steady pace, unhindered by the fog, and gaining ground on us. Sarah was struggling to even walk with the fog pulling at her. I flashed back to Sarah and I in middle school, making the ill-advised decision to take a shortcut through an unplowed access road after a massive blizzard. With nearly waist-deep snow, every step was a battle, and Sarah collapsed midway through, sobbing and unable to continue. The tiny thing just wasn't built for it like I was. I got her home that day by playing bulldozer for her. Instead of stepping over the snow, I had dragged my leg straight through it, leaving a clear path behind me. Sarah stumbled again, and I rushed to her side as the captain closed in. I can't, Sarah sobbed, collapsing. Blizzard of 69. Remember the access road? Same plan. Stay close, I yelled, dragging her back to her feet. My leg muscles screamed in agony as I forced my way through the dense fog, causing it to dissipate long enough for Sarah to sneak through behind me before it recongealed. It was working, but I couldn't maintain this pace for long. So I grabbed my phone and hit send on my pre-written text. Sarah injured, can't carry. You or her. 10 seconds. My phone vibrated in response. A moment later was Simon's one-word reply. Monster. And then it was over. The fog evaporated as quickly as it had arrived, sending Sarah and I crashing to the ground. The captain was gone for another decade. Sarah suffered a severe mental breakdown following Simon's death, spending a bit of time inpatient and losing her job and family in the process. She had refused my calls and blocked me on social media, so I was pleasantly surprised when she reached out to invite me to visit her home on December 31st, 2012. I'd spent the decade hashing out and scrapping one plan after another, even considering laying a series of ramps from rooftop to rooftop as a way to avoid the supernatural fog. I hadn't seen Sarah in 10 years, and it was all I could do not to sob at the sight of the shattered wreck of my lifelong best friend. Emaciated with sunken, haunted eyes, greasy, unwashed hair, shuffling about in an ill-fitting robe, I'm not certain I would have recognized her passing on the street. I pulled her into a hug when she opened the front door, but she was limp in my arms. Heavily medicated, I thought at the time. We sat down in her living room where I struggled to make small talk for several minutes until she suddenly burst to life, screaming that I'd killed Russ, Simon, and even Darren somehow. She was wild-eyed, unhinged. I tried to calm her, to explain that we had no choice. It was them or us. And then she grabbed the handgun from her robe pocket. I was surprised to feel relief in that moment, that I might die a natural death and escape the curse we'd unleashed. And then she raised the gun to her own head, threatening to kill herself so the captain would have only me to claim at midnight. For the first time in this whole ordeal, I felt true terror. A scenario I couldn't scheme my way out of. She was right. If she killed herself, the captain would come for me at midnight, and there would be no one left to hide behind. I panicked and reacted badly.
No. No.
I snatched the gun from Sarah and hit her with something, a lamp.
Sarah, no.
Maybe it all happened so fast. I waited until 11:50, then left Sarah bound and gagged in the closet of her apartment. I barely caught a glimpse of the captain that cycle. Gone mere seconds after he appeared and taking with him forever my lifelong best friend. Over the past decade, I regularly thought about ending it. And I likely would have if I believed it would end the curse. But what if it didn't? And killing myself just hastened my fate. What if I still found myself tangled in seaweed and struggling in vain for all eternity to reach the surface? Like Darren and Russ and Simon and Sarah. All the terrible things I've done to survive the past 50 years would be for naught. Now, there's nowhere left to run. No one left to hide behind. And 5 minutes until midnight when the captain makes his final visit. I've come to accept that my only hope is to do what we should have done 5 decades ago. The old lighthouse keeper's cottage is up ahead, and it looks like they never fixed the door. Why would they, I guess? Stepping back into the cottage for the first time in 50 years, I could almost hear the laughter of those 5 dumb kids half a century ago. I'd give anything to start over from that night and do it all different. But it's too late for that now. 4 of those dumb kids are now dead, with the 5th likely soon to follow. The scene of our crime, abandoned to time. Moss covering the interior, the lighthouse claimed by the ocean over the years, is just another rock formation, forgotten by mankind. It was that fact, if anything, that provided my one shot at salvation. Ah! Oh, it's just the window. Oh, what am I doing? How did I convince myself this was a good idea? I should go. Oh, fuck! 3 minutes, it's too late. Here goes nothing.
You've reached the office of Sheriff Danita Hudson. If this is an emergency, call 911. If not, leave a message and I'll get right back with you.
Danita, it's Emma Robinson. I don't know if you remember me, but we went to school together a long time ago. On December 31st, 1972, along with Darren Walker, Russ Aubrey, Simon Wellesley, and Sarah Van Buren, I vandalized the lighthouse at Walker Point, disabling it and causing the wreck of the vessel A New Dawn and the death of Captain Jebediah Freeman. I'm back in town, and if it is within my power, I'll be at your office first thing in the morning to turn myself in. I'm so sorry. All right. No going back now. Oh, 90 seconds till midnight. Holy shit, holy shit. I can't. Come on, Emma. Breathe. It's gonna work. It's gonna work. Just like you practice. Stick to the plan. Trust the plan. Always trust the plan. Okay, okay, okay. Okay, okay, okay. All or nothing. Here we go. Jebediah Freeman, my friends and I wronged you 50 years ago. We then lied to avoid justice and turned on each other rather than own up to our crimes. Your death was unjust, undeserved, and it was our fault. It was my fault. I could have stopped it. I should have stopped it. I'm sorry. We didn't mean to hurt anyone, to kill anyone. We were kids. I just confessed to the police. In the morning, I'll turn myself in and plead guilty to whatever they charge me with. Please, you don't have to do this. I'm making things right. You can rest now. Justice will be served. You died a hero, Jebediah, trying to help someone in distress. I want you to know that your sacrifice wasn't forgotten, that you weren't forgotten. You were a man once, a good man. I'm sorry we hurt you. We didn't mean to. I swear, we didn't know. I mean, how could we know? It was all a terrible mistake. Last month, I got the state to rename Walker Point in your honor. This is Freeman Point now. Your name will be immortalized as part of Maine history. Please, I'm trying to make things right. Just let me go. You can let me go. No!
Your name is Jebediah Freeman. You live in 17 Overlook Lane in the house your father built. You have a family who loves you and misses you. They don't want you to exist like this. They want you to be at peace. You were posthumously awarded the Gold Life-Saving Cross by the Coast Guard for your efforts on December 31st, 1972. Please, no, please. Oh, the fog's too thick. I'm trapped. Wait, stop, stop. What do you want from me? That was 50 fucking years ago. I was a child. You've ruined my entire life, made me betray and destroy the only friends I've ever had. I've confessed. I'll get locked up. I've lost everything to you. There's nothing left to take. I spent half a century running from you. If you're gonna do it, just do it already. I'm done running. Do it. Wait. He's gone. Oh my God. He's really gone. Oh, the fog's clearing. I can move. Oh, I can move. It's real. 12:02 a.m. and he's gone. He's gone. It's finally over. I did it. I really did it. I'm alive. Oh. Okay. Oh, I need to get as far away from this place as possible right the fuck now. Oh, if I never see this pier again, it will be too soon. Okay. So, new plan. I confess to the sheriff, but I can still spin that. Russ broke the lighthouse anyway, not me. I can get out of this with probation. Finally start my life for real this time. I just gotta... Wait, what was... Oh, God, no. How can you be back? What? Whoa. Darren? What's going... What are you... Russ! Oh, wait, no. No, it wasn't me. I can explain. Simon. Oh, God, no, please. You have to understand. I was just... Sarah? No, you know I would never. I was only trying to... I saved you. I saved you twice. I gave you 20 years. I killed Simon for you. No, Simon. Wait, I didn't mean that.
Well, it seems Emma got what was coming, but was a different path ever possible? We won't know now that she is caught in the Undertow. We're leaving Blackout Point, but there's a dark, winding road ahead of us yet. We'll be exploring the mysteries of a terrifying book, The Dark Tome, on the weeks ahead here on Undertow.
Every 5 minutes, a transplant candidate dies while waiting for a compatible heart, liver, or kidney. Imagine a technology that could provide those life-saving transplant organs for a high price, and imagine what a company would do to monopolize that technology. On a remote island in Lake Superior, a team of geneticists unlocks this holy grail of medicine by reverse engineering the genomes of all mammals, creating an animal with organs perfectly suitable for human transplantation. They envisioned a docile herd animal, but one team member had another, darker vision. This ancestor is anything but docile. The team's work spawns something big, something evil, something very, very hungry. Ancestor is a complete serialized fiction podcast by number one New York Times bestselling novelist Scott Sigler, with all episodes available. Binge the entire story now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Return to Blackout Point is a Realm original production, written by Sean French, produced by Rhoda Baeza and Fred Greenhalgh, directed by Fred Greenhalgh. Starring Carol Potter, with creature voices by Fred Greenhalgh. Dialogue editing by Corey Barton. Sound design and mixing by Rory O'Shea. Original score and composition by Marcus Thorne Bagala. Production manager, Devin Shepard. Production coordinator, Angela Yee. Casting by Sunday Bowling and Meg Mormon. Executive in charge for Realm, Mary Azadolahi. Undertow is a production of Realm. Hosted by Fred Greenhalgh. Produced by Mary Azadolahi. Associate produced by Nicole Kreuter and Alexis Latshaw. Executive produced by Fred Greenhalgh, Molly Barton, and Marcy Wiseman. Original theme by Hubert Campbell. Cover art by Kendall Thomas. Find more shows like Undertow by following Realm on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or at realm.fm. Realm is your portal to another world. Listen away.